Save big money on everything at Menards. Take control of your outdoor space with Roundup, Weed, and Grass Killer. The Pump and Go container is ready and easy to use. With the Pump and Go sprayer, you don't need to mix your own liquid, and you get up to 10 minutes of continuous spray. Save big on Roundup, Weed, and Grass Killer. Plus, check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Save big money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of bagged concrete and mortar mixes, great for any project. Whether you're pouring a walkway, a concrete slab, or setting a post. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome to Formative Media with me, Christian Spicer, the show that celebrates the media that inspires, influences, and defines us. Joining me on today's show is musician, songwriter, and music producer, Tim McEwen.
I was watching the movie yesterday and I wrote, no one does horror and awe like Spielberg. And it's that this wonder, horror and awe, and he combines it, you know. It's that shot when Sam Neill and Laura Dern drive up in the Jeeps and he turns Laura Dern's head because she's reading. It's that thing of taking off your glasses, the pull in, and that's Spielberg. That's when you know from what they're seeing, this must be amazing. And then its payoff is when you see it. And that's exactly it. Yeah, he's a king of that.
You might know Tim from his synthwave band, The Midnight. Or if nothing else, you know Tim for making the intro song for this very podcast, something I will be eternally grateful for. You can find The Midnight's newest album, Syndicate, wherever you get your music, and you can see them live across the United States this April and May. But today we're not here just to talk about The Midnight. Today we're here to talk Jurassic Park, and we'll get to that in just a bit. But first, I need to mention the reason this show will continue will be because of our patrons over at patreon.com/formativemediashow. We are just getting started, and your support is what makes this show possible. By supporting us at patreon.com/formativemediashow, you can get ad-free versions of this show, access to the patron-exclusive community chat, and our bonus show, Zeitgeist, with me, Nicole Zavalich, and Khalif Adams in audio and video form, plus the twice-a-year State of the Show community live chat. All right, with that said, we will get in our Jeep and go to Jurassic Park with Tim right after this quick ad break. Today, we are talking Jurassic Park.
The entire planet, the most phenomenal discovery of our time.
How'd you do this?
Becomes the greatest adventure of all time.
Jurassic Park was released in the United States on June 9th, 1993. And neither here nor there, per se, but the summer of 93 also gave us the original Super Mario Brothers movie.
I got a feeling we're not in Brooklyn no more.
Yeah, not quite the box office powerhouse the animated films are, but it sure was a movie.
Super Mario Brothers. This ain't no game.
The summer of 93 also gave us The Fugitive.
Are you saying that I killed my wife?
Hocus Pocus.
Hello, you.
Nothing like Halloween in the summer. And Sleepless in Seattle.
What if I never meet him? What if this man is my destiny and I never meet him?
Your destiny can be your doom.
Among others. But back to Jurassic Park.
Hold on to your butts.
It was directed by Steven Spielberg and based on the novel of the same name written by Michael Crichton. The three leads are played by Sam Neill, Laura Dern, and Jeff Goldblum. And the movie was a huge hit, becoming the highest grossing film released worldwide at the time, a blockbuster through and through. So let's get to it already.
Jurassic Park.
Can I do the welcome to, or do you want to do the welcome
no,
to?
No, please do it. Let's hear it.
Okay, here we go. Welcome to Jurassic Park.
That was good.
Is it pretty good?
That was very good. I was surprised by your trailer voice, because it's actually, obviously it's, what's his name? Dr. Hammond that says it. And he's more, I think it has a bit more adventurous majesty to it.
Okay.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
But hearing it in sort of Don LaFontaine trailer voice terms, that was pretty good.
I want to look this up now, because what I was going to do as my Dr. John Hammond voice then would be, okay, welcome to Jurassic Park.
Why do you sound like the guy from what's the Futurama? Isn't that the man? Okay. He's sounding like
Grandpa
the mad
Simpson.
Scientist.
Yeah,
that's Grandpa Simpson, exactly.
Because in my viewing head, Dr. Hammond is an old man, right? Like a grandpa. But
yes,
probably
he is. Yeah.
But probably was my age, you know, like when
that's true. Yeah. Skincare hadn't come as far back then. With the way you portrayed him here, he sounds like this frail old man that can't be trusted. Everyone's like, all right, just that, like, and he's like, look, children, look at what I've built. And there's nothing there. It's just all his head. And everyone's like, just nod and smile. It's like, well, Grandpa's at it again. I own an island off the coast of the... It's like, you know, Granddad, we're in your backyard. It's like,
yeah. Okay, Grandma, let's get you back to bed.
So this is a Wendy's drive-through. We're starting off hot and heavy and really like laying into, let's dig into Jurassic Park. Is it really that good? It's going to be my angle today.
Would you even call it a park? I didn't see any slides or swings.
This did nothing for me.
And so just to clear this up, Dr. John Hammond was played by Richard Attenborough, who was 69, 70 years old when Jurassic Park came out in 1993. And in my humble opinion, he knocked that role out of the Jurassic Park. There was warmth to him, but also this layer of hubris, right? It was his park. Ah, the whole movie was just so good, though. Top tier through and through.
This is gonna be a love fest, and I am also on Letterboxd. I have some friends that have a great podcast called 70 Millimeter, and they were instrumental in getting me on that platform and kind of being, you know, kind of understanding what a fun kind of little social media world it is for movie lovers and reviewing movies. And so there will be a 5-star review of Jurassic Park dropping right after this ep, guys.
Spoiler alert, that review is live and you can find it on Tim's profile right now over on Letterboxd. Also, spoiler, you can probably already guess how many stars he gives the movie. I mean, come on.
I have no patience for people that can't give Jurassic Park 5 stars.
I want to zoom out a little bit back to, you know, music producer, songwriter, artist. I want to talk a little bit about that. And then from there, maybe jump into how Jurassic Park was perhaps formative for you as a person today.
Yeah.
Because the John Williams score, in my opinion, incredible, absolutely incredible.
Amazing.
A big part of that movie. But I'm curious how Jurassic Park perhaps was formative for you today working in the music business. Like, what about seeing that film kind of stuck with you, and maybe it didn't, but perhaps did, like, influence you to be the artist you are now?
100%. I mean, it's like, where do I start? So let's go back in time, folks. Let me take you back in time, to when
the Jurassic period,
when I was but a boy wearing my little trilby to school or whatever I was wearing, I grew up in Denmark, and, I just have a distinct memory. I was 13 years old, when this movie came out, and I have a distinct memory of going to with my family to watch it in I don't know if there's going to be any Danish listeners eventually to this one, but if they I grew up in a little suburb to Copenhagen called Søborg, in the municipality of what's called Gladsaxe, and we drove to nearby city called Lyngby, which everyone in Denmark will know. Lovely little city, suburb to Copenhagen, and they had some movie theaters, and it was kind of where you would go. It was kind of closest to us to go watch a movie. And I just have this core memory of going to this specific movie theater and watching Jurassic Park with my dad and my mom and my brother. And I was at, you know, at the peak, like 13 years old. Like, you're just in the sweet spot for kind of the awe, the beauty, the craftsmanship that Steven Spielberg can bring, but susceptible to the horror of it all and how scary it is. But I was just old enough to be like, to get it all and brave through it. And kind of like, it's scary, but it wasn't like a scarring experience. It was when I was like, oh my, it was everything, right? It was like, I think I had like a tiny crush on the girl, the young girl who's probably similar to my age or a little bit older. And I could see, you know, even though he's a bit younger, but little Tim in the movie, a little kid, you know, you see it through the kid's eyes. So they're, it's all new to you. And I was just in that sweet spot where everything was designed to just hit me on an emotional level. And it did. And I think I must have seen the film, and then maybe for my birthday a couple of months later or something, I got a book, and it was like the storyboards for the film. It's a behind the scenes pictures and, you know, little things. And it was a full book with a lot of the story. There was the storyboards from the scene in the kitchen with the raptors with the two kids.
Okay.
And so, you know, these are all storyboarded by Steven Spielberg. I was watching something, an interview with him, and he said he storyboarded all of it. And it got me to think of how this movie is probably the pinnacle of just, I would say, a masterwork of set pieces, set piece after set piece after set piece after set piece. It's these intricately designed, you know, scenes that are set up and pay off, set up and pay off. And it's so intricate. And Steven Spielberg was just saying how he loves to draw, because you can kind of draw anything. So he was having a lot of fun thinking it up, because you have no limitations. And when you start from that place, you usually get a lot more fun out of the whole thing. And so it just feels, I remember reading the book and having watched the movie and kind of reliving the book in my mind many, many times, many evenings before falling asleep.
Speaking of Steven Spielberg and storyboarding, here's a snippet of an interview Steven did back in 1978 when discussing Close Encounters of the Third Kind over at AFI.
I do most of the original sketches myself that I don't save. I do stick figures and things. I can do perspectives. I can at least put depth in drawings, but I can't draw. And I'll give the sketch artist an idea of what I want. I'll say, okay, you put Lacombe in the foreground like this, and then you put Neary in the middle plane, and then the background, we've got 40 of our extras and the ship's back there. And I pretty much outline the composition and of course, the concept, the thought.
It's a deep core memory peak, I would say, Spielberg, before he eventually came the more kind of mature. He was making Schindler's List at the time as well, which is, you know, a mind F in itself to have to make those two movies. So that's kind of my starting point. Like, that's kind of where I find myself.
I love that, the idea of you in the storyboards in that book.
Yeah.
Because it was of a time where, you know, we were getting licensed products, at least here in the United States, like Jurassic Park launched with like the make sure it says JP on the toy, so it's a real Jurassic Park dinosaur. Like, merchandising was a thing then in 1993, but you couldn't immediately rewatch the movie the way my children can now. They'll be like, oh, true. I loved, you know, whatever, pick your Zootopia, and now I'm going to watch it again and again and again, and they can relive it. Whereas when Jurassic Park came out, it was this huge blockbuster of its time, you know, and still huge today in terms of its box office receipts. But as a child, when you were trying to seek out more of it, you could either drive to that Danish town and beg your parents to take you to see it again, or you have this physical book that you're kind of poring over. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that connection for you helped it embed even more in your memory, because you 100%. Have this physical thing that you're sitting there obsessing over with, and then also imagining your experience at the movie theater.
100%. It's funny, I never thought about that, but that's obviously true. I think today we tend to, in this digital age, we are all, I've noticed everyone seeking that tactile experience of holding something in your hand, you know. That's why the sale of vinyl records has gone up in the last 10, 15 years. And people are buying cassette tapes and CDs, and bookstores are coming back in a new way, in a different way. I've read something about that, and you know, numbers show. And it's like, we're all seeking a bit more of a tactile experience. And that's exactly true. I think you hit the nail on the head. Me lying there, being able to kind of walk through the story in my head as I sit and read and relive these moments definitely helped it embed it itself deep in my like psyche, I think. I think that's spot on. You should start the podcast or something.
No, this is, I just told you this was a podcast so you'd hang out with me. This is just us.
You're right. Rightly so. Otherwise, I'd be out of here, my friend.
Done. I wonder if that point about, you know, you're saying about craving that tactile connection is also why Jurassic Park still resonates for folks today, because so many of those creatures were tactile constructions. It was an age of special effects not quite being all 100% digital. And now folks are currently, you're certainly going back to, you know, real locations and real practical effects as well.
Sometimes, right? But I think it's very sometimes. CGI heavy in big budget movie. I feel like I'm the old kind of man yelling at cloud, because today's movies feel more digital, feel more like video games. And I've had to accept, like, it's just an aesthetic, and the kids nowadays are not, they're used to video games. So it's like, oh, that's what movies look like. And to me, I'm 46 now. So I it's not because I'm like, the world has changed. It's just like, I recognize that things have changed and the movie industry is different. And there was something to that age and the way they marry CGI with practical effects. Like, it's not done in the same way for the most part these days. It all feels so that there's zero gravity. It all feels very plasticky, very, it's not a dig at anyone. It's like budgets are different and the pressures, it's become so corporatized. So we all know that, but that is what I'm seeing. And that's why I tend to, at this point in my life, go back and rewatch stuff from the 80s, 90s, and even 2000s a lot more. That's kind of my predominantly what I go back. I just rewatched the whole 7 seasons of The West Wing. But yes, I think there's something to how real it felt, how lived in it all felt. Like, you can really see that's real rain on that T-Rex in that scene, even though that caused them so many problems, because it wasn't built for rain and it made it heavy and the machinery couldn't. But like, it's a testament to the whole crew, everyone at their peak of their game, just trying to make something that is special. And you see it, it's right there.
100%. I agree. After walking out of the theater and spending time looking at the storyboard book, did you ever feel this call to get into movies, motion pictures, storyboarding? Was that kind of inspiring for you? Or is it more like the awe and the wonder and kind of creating these grand worlds?
It was the storytelling of it. It wasn't something that I was never drawn to making movies in that sense, but the storytelling aspect of it. And I think, interestingly enough, with my band The Midnight, any time I make music, I really love relishing in the sound design aspect of it, the sort of making it. I look at myself in a weird way, and this is not coming from like a place of ego, but I look at myself as more like the Steven Spielberg of producers, because I love the big, I think it's the same approach. Scope is big. The emotions are intimate. It's impactful. It can be epic, but it can be small. It can be quiet. Like, he can do the whole spectrum. And that's what I love about music. And I try to, I think it translates in that way, that he's able to wrangle tones very well. Steven Spielberg is one of the best about tone. Yeah. So his whole storytelling approach, and how impactful it is visually, and think about movies like E.T. and, you know, it's like iconic imagery, but none of that matters if you don't have a story with heart or something that resonates on a deeper emotional level. And that's how I tend to approach my music. Is I love all the visual. I love the beauty of it. I love the sonic you know, I guess you could call it sonic visuals, which doesn't make sense, but the sort of the palette, which is very, can be very big and deep and emotive, but then there's got to be heart behind it. Otherwise it doesn't matter.
As someone who's been very fortunate to see your band, The Midnight Live, several times and am that tactile guy and own a lot of it on vinyl, I love thinking about it in that way of like a Spielbergian sense being, you know, perhaps your North Star or a guiding star and how that stuff totally is created. I think that contextualizes it in a really cool way for me, because there is something about Steven Spielberg where I feel like he is able to tap into wonder and awe.
It's funny. My second note, I was watching the movie yesterday and I wrote, no one does horror and awe like Spielberg. And it's that this wonder, horror and awe, and he combines it, you know. It's that shot when Sam Neill and Laura Dern drive up in the Jeeps and he turns Laura Dern's head because she's reading. It's that thing of taking off your glasses, the pull in, and that's Spielberg. That's when you know from what they're seeing, this must be amazing. And then payoff is when you see it. And that's exactly it. Yeah. He's a king of that.
Yeah. And I feel like that is something that as adults we lose.
Yeah.
You know, I try to tell myself to take time to appreciate the sunrise and the sunset and these beautiful things that, you know, I think as we get older, not to project, as I get older, I perhaps become more jaded or take things for granted. Mm-hmm. And Steven Spielberg, and I think especially in Jurassic Park, is able to do this thing of reminding you, the audience, of how beautiful and special the world can be. And I feel like your point about it being built around these set pieces is such a wonderful way to describe those moments where you have that when they're first on the island and you know, Laura Dern in the glasses, you have the T-Rex in the atrium, you have the velociraptors in the kitchen, you have the velociraptors outside, you know, clever girl, you have yeah. all of these moments that like tell you how beautiful, but at the same time, dangerous the world is. And I think yeah. that connects with kids at such a, yes, that's what the world is. And then for adults reminds us of where we were and what we used to be, instead of now it's like, well, yeah, I'm jaded.
And it's a really good point you made that speaks to another big part of how Spielberg approached this movie. He realized early on that this couldn't be just a creature movie, a monster movie, which I think I saw him say something to the effect of, up until then, anything regarding dinosaurs was treated as a creature movie in the past. The old ones that he grew up with, it was all about, ooh, you know, 10,000 BC and oh my, be careful of the dangerous raptor and dangerous T-Rex and whatever. But he wanted to treat them like animals and also capture the beauty and gentleness of them as creatures. And you see that, you know, your first spoilers, everyone who hasn't seen we're going to spoil Jurassic Park. The first scene is very much like your horror kind of set, like, oh man, and we're not really seeing the raptor and one guy gets killed and
shoot her! Shoot her!
But then after that, it's, you know, you have the brilliant way of doing exposition with the kind of tour and Mr. DNA explaining it for kids as he would in a real guided tour. And like, it's so perfectly executed.
Blood from the mosquito and bingo, dino DNA.
Amazing screenplay, amazing cast. This is all of it. But you see, you know, the sort of beauty and horror of life being formed in the egg, you know, the little raptor baby.
Come on, little one. Come on. Come on.
But then you see the majestic kind of, well, this is right before that. You see them roll up and see the, is it Brachiosaurus or whatever? The big ones, the big happy cows.
In my head, it's a Brontosaurus, but I don't know.
It's probably
a Brachiosaurus is the actual, because they used, in my head, there's five dinosaurs in my head. Brontosaurus, Triceratops, T-Rex, Raptor, and then the one I can't think of that has the spines down its back. Those are the only dinosaurs that
exist.
Those
are the ones that exist. I think those are the only ones that exist, period. But anyway, it's like you see the beauty and the gentleness of the big Triceratops, I think the one that's lying there. I mean, that's the first time you see one up close in the film, I think. It's like, and you see, I remember seeing an interview with special effects creators, and they said they knew this was their only shot to really like show this is not just a beast that's gonna kill. It's like, here's an animal in distress or in pain. And it's heartbreak. It's really emotional, that scene when they walk up, you see come through the grass and you see this beautiful creature lying there. And it's an animal.
What are her symptoms?
Imbalance, disorientation, labored breathing. It seems to happen about every 6 weeks or so.
6 weeks. These are dilated.
They
Take
are?
A look.
It's okay. I'll be damned.
It's pharmacological and local plant life.
And it could be an elephant in pain or in need, or it could be a rhino or whatever. You could be in the savannah in mm-hmm. Africa. And so I think that connection allows you for a lot more empathy, and you're empathizing with, I empathize with the raptors. I love animals. So I think it's hard for me to watch at this point in my life when I'm an adult to see how those raptors, they didn't ask for that, right? They just were born. That's the whole crux of the whole story, is what are we doing? And we could talk about that for hours in the world, what we're doing to the planet and animals, but to humans. But I think to approach it with that level of empathy is what allows for a much more resonant story, a story that resonates on a way deeper level.
You mentioned how the children are used as a proxy in the film as well to help, I think, bring viewers in and give that perspective of, you know, not the scientist, as much as it would be fun to spend the whole movie with, sexy Jeff Goldblum lounging with his shirt off the whole time.
Oh, boy. But is he ever sexy? Oh, my God. Is this the first? I think this is, I wrote this. Is this the birth of the Goldblum that we know? Was that this movie? Like before?
Oh, like
the sort of like, the whole kind of eccentric kind of, he's so sexual. Remember that moment when he walks up to that big pile of poo? He saunters up to it and stands there and he looks at it and he looks so hot and sexy. And I'm like, are you trying to hit on this bunch of poo, bro? He's just so sexual, and he's so perfectly cast, but he leans into sort of his eccentricities more than I had seen him do that before. I was young, but when I go back and watch his movies, there's a movie with Michelle Pfeiffer and him called Into the Night from the 80s. So maybe like 6, 7, 8 years before that. But he's playing things much more straight. And it seems to be after that movie that he becomes, you know, then there's Independence Day a couple of years later.
Yeah.
And that's when he becomes Goldblum. But I feel like that was the birth of like the Goldblum that we know and love today. I don't know. It's my theory.
Yeah, I very well could be. But I wanted to talk about the children, kind of using the children as a proxy for the audience, perhaps, or as a way in for the audience. I'm curious, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I'm curious if that idea of childhood and using children and using your memories of childhood and that kind of wonder, if that has kind of also been a calling card for you in your work musically. Because when I listen to a lot of your work, it certainly brings me back to that, of this not only being nostalgic for my childhood, but being nostalgic for childhood. Mm. And I think Jurassic Park does a lot of that as well. It's not remember when you were this age, because I think my dad loved the film and he was, you know, he wasn't a child in the 90s, obviously, mm-hmm. but like nostalgic for the idea of being a child again and having that wonder.
Yes.
Is that something that you kind of look for artistically?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. It's true what you say. With The Midnight, with just synthwave in general, and what I love about making music.
I truly love pretty much everything Tim in The Midnight release. Like, their music just hits for me. I think my current favorite, the Midnight song, is still Change Your Heart or Die, but I also have their album Kids regularly spinning on my record player. The way that album closes with Arcade Dreams and then into the reprise of the song Kids is just such a memory for me. Not a vibe, not a feeling, but like a real memory. It's beautiful. a little haunting, but also inspiring. The past is gone, but the future will become the past all the same. Somehow it just really inspires me to focus on the present, as beautiful and as messy as it is. And that's a theme I think Jurassic Park plays with too. Anyway, here's a little of the intro to Arcade Dreams as we get back to Tim.
It's a way to recreate a feeling that I miss, or like a simplistic outlook on life or on the world, or your sort of view of your understanding of the world. If you can recreate a feeling that takes you back to that place, it can feel like a little bit of a respite somehow. And movies can do the same. Jurassic, you know, putting on Jurassic Park or E.T. or whatever it is, can be an escape for a bit, or a respite, or just kind of a nice, warm, safe place to land sometimes, just to, you know. And I find myself doing that a lot these days, kind of retreating back into my, you know, cozy couch and putting on something that I'm either familiar with or something from a time that was more formative for me. The world seemed simpler back then. I'm sure it wasn't. I think, you know, in many ways it has become more complicated for sure, with social media, with internet, all that stuff. But I think there's also good with that. So I think we just keep, as the human race, we just keep expanding. And with that comes more good, more bad. And we're the ones that have to sift through it. But being able to kind of create a mood where you feel like you're in sort of a womb or something, that certainly is real for me. And that's what I love about making music. And it's the same thing as putting on an old film for me, you know, or an old TV show, or hearing an old song that takes you back to when you were, you know, 6 years old, and you just instantly are back in your parents' living room, and you remember your understanding of life back then, which was so much simpler.
There is something about, I think, the way Spielberg presented his films at the time that immediately, at least for me, kind of tapped into that part of my brain that was like, I get this. Like, I know the place, I know what's happening, I could picture myself maybe being there or being along on this adventure in some form or fashion. And I think there's something about that that makes it stay relevant long after its initial run.
What do you mean, like that he builds this world so completely that it feels very easy to immerse yourself into and put yourself there? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I think part of it is the way he, I think, ties a lot of things emotionally to family to children.
That's a good point.
to that perspective of children or family, I think, yeah, allowed me certainly to feel safe in a scary situation.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it works on multiple levels, but I think you're right. That's Steven Spielberg's MO. That's what makes it powerful. That's what driven him for many years. A movie that is not as well reviewed or regarded, but I think I have deep nostalgia for it, is Hook, the Peter Pan film from, what is that, 91 or something?
1991, yep.
Boom. You know, all about fathers and sons and children and remaining a child and, you know, staying there and growing up but not growing. It's all embedded in all his movies, I'd say. Yeah, I forgot the question, but...
No, it's perfect. It's beautiful. I'm going to change gears a little bit. When I say Jurassic Park, what's the first image you picture?
Oh, the logo. The logo is probably it's so timeless. I mean, I was thinking this last night. The set design, the art direction for the whole film is so specific and so clear, and it all feels so cohesive throughout the film. This, you know, it's genius marketing, because it's perfect for someone who, like Spielberg, has made these blockbusters, you know, Jaws and all the Indiana Jones films, and then E.T. and all that stuff. And then you have Jurassic Park that is literally in the movie, is a theme park. So all the, there's a couple of shots where you see inside the, you know, the restaurant or whatever, the gift shop or whatever, and you see the t-shirts. Like, this is all the all these t-shirts, you can buy them on eBay now. Like, you can, they became, so the merchandise in the movie, what became the merchandise in, you know, you put that logo on a lunchbox and you, it was everywhere. It was kind of like the Batman, the 89 Batman. It was like, you couldn't go to school without seeing someone wearing a Jurassic Park t-shirt or, you know, a Jurassic Park lunchbox or having a poster at home. It was like part of your childhood, you know. I like the Batman, gold Batman logo by Tim Burton was the same, like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. There was just like stuff that was part of the tapestry of being a kid in the 80s and the 90s. And Jurassic Park, the logo is just right there. And the way they put it above the big gates, almost like the, which is, I think, also an homage to King Kong and Goldblum's character name checks King Kong, but an homage to that. But you have that lettering, that font, the style is just like timeless, and it is just such a striking visual. And the way the park looks, all the, you know, the specific cars, the colors, the logo on the car, everything is so cohesive. So it's just like so well thought out, the whole thing.
Tim is absolutely right. The way Jurassic Park managed to show you the logo and merch in the movie at the gift shop in the park that you could then buy IRL was just an absolute masterstroke of marketing and advertising. And speaking of advertising, we're going to take a quick ad break ourselves and then re-enter the park with Tim. There's the New York Times review from 1993. Mm-hmm. It leads with Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park is a true movie milestone, presenting awe and fear inspiring sights never before seen on the screen. Mm. And I feel like we've talked about that. And later it says, much scarier, however, are the aspects of Jurassic Park that establish it as the overnight flagship of a brand new entertainment empire. Even while capturing the imagination of its audience, this film lays the groundwork for theme park rides, sequels, and souvenirs that ensure the Jurassic Park experience will live on and on and on.
Yeah.
And I feel like you talked about that a little bit of,
do they, it's like, do they mean in the movie or do they mean as the movie in this world we're living in, where it was a machine for merchandise and so that it can continue. Books with storyboards, like for little kids like me, you know? Yeah, that's really astute. And I mean, it's all of it. I mean, I don't want to skip over John Williams' theme either. Like, you can't go unnoticed, or, oh, you know, we can't talk about Jurassic Park without talking about that theme. And speaking of wonder and awe, you know, that's, John Williams brings that and so much more.
There's this quote by Steven Spielberg from the 2016 AFI Life Achievement Award given to John Williams, where Steven says, well, here, just let him say it.
Without John Williams, bikes don't really fly. Nor do brooms in Quidditch matches, nor do men in red capes. There is no force. Dinosaurs do not walk the earth. We do not wonder. We do not weep. We do not believe.
And man, oh man, is that so true. What John Williams has added to many of our favorite movies is just truly undeniable. If you had to pick one scene of a movie arguably full of incredible scenes, what's your defining scene from Jurassic Park?
Oh my God. A defining scene from Jurassic Park that's like, You mean like that or just something that sticks out to me, or what do you mean?
Yeah, just yours, however you want to interpret it. If it's something that encapsulates the themes of the film, if that's kind of how you read it, great. If it's just like when you close your eyes at night and you picture Jurassic Park, you're the first scene that comes to mind. What's that moment?
Oh, God, there's so many. It's so many. I'll narrow it down to opposite extremes or anything, but the one shot where they fly and you hear do, I think it's the theme that comes in there. If they fly into Hawaii where it was shot and you hear the theme and it's, you know, they land with the helicopter, that kind of is like we're approaching, you know, Jurassic Park, and it's so iconic. It's so familiar. But also what sort of encapsulate the movie, but is sort of the shot that comes to mind is the very end of the movie is the shot where the T-Rex has just killed the two raptors. The people escape and you see T-Rex roaring inside of the sort of hallway, the lobby, as the bones have fallen to the ground and he's killed the two. You know, he remains the hero, sort of undefeated. You see this sort of banner, like when dinosaurs ruled the earth, fall across the screen. It's like it's perfect Spielberg shot. And I have to guess that banner is also CGI somehow, even though it looks, I mean, the effects of this film hold up so incredibly well. It's just crazy. But yeah, those two shots, the flying in with the theme and then the T-Rex roaring, sort of his last power roar, and then they fly away. It's all magical. This movie straddles the line between adventure and action and then abject horror. And it goes from day to night there. It starts raining and we're at night, and that's when Spielberg chooses to have us, you know, get attacked by the T-Rex. So it's perfect. It's a perfect setup.
And the beauty of payoffs as well, like hearing about a thing, being told such a thing can't exist, learning that it does or might, what that means, seeing the violence of it on something else, on the goat.
Yeah.
And then knowing that at some point you have to pay this thing off as an artist, right? Like in the way that Spielberg and company then choose to pay it off is just timed so perfectly, including my youngest daughter's favorite scene when the lawyer gets eaten.
I was just going to ask you, I have a note here going, how did you feel about seeing the lawyer getting it, Christian? How does that make you feel? Didn't you study law at some point?
Yeah, I practiced for a while. I mean, it's such a wonderful scene because here's a character that could become a major part of the film, right? They don't set him up immediately as this side character, like could easily be a foil for this entire adventure. Mm-hmm. Or a MacGuffin they have to keep going to rescue because he keeps getting himself in these horrible situations.
Yeah.
You don't like him. You know, he kind of is abrasive and annoying and rubbing against our heroes the wrong way. And then he's just gone. It's like, what's that other Samuel L. Jackson movie, Deep Sea? Spoiler for Deep Sea, wherever, like
Deep Blue Sea.
It's like Samuel L. Jackson, he's sitting there and then like the shark just comes out and gets him. And you're
true. Yeah.
I guess he's not the lead of this movie. Yeah. And it's like when that... And now immediately it's like, oh, no one's safe. You know, there's this idea that no one's safe, and it's done so well.
Well, it's true. It's perfectly set up, right? Because you're setting him up as someone who's not the most likable. He hasn't proved to be like a full-on villain. He's not the villain. Oh my God. It's just like, this guy seems kind of, he's a lawyer. He's there to... And so when he goes, no one's like, oh my God, I love that guy. You know, it's not... no one's going to miss him, but he's ingrained enough as part of the ensemble that when he does go as one of the first ones to go, he's the first one to go, I believe. It feels enough like, oh my God, now anyone could go, because he wasn't set up completely as an absolute asshole. He's just gray enough for you to not miss him, but also that it comes like a shot, like, oh my God, how he goes is so full on horror movie, right? You're in a straight up horror movie now, even though there are like moments of levity and all that stuff. But yes, that's the way he goes sets a tone for like, this is, you know, this is going to go there. It's going to be pretty graphic. This is PG-13, right?
Yeah. It's a pretty heavy PG-13.
That's what Spielberg was able to do back then, was make these movies that were like pretty dark because the themes are dark and you may not see, you know, enough or a lot of blood, but the way he goes is pretty graphic. It's pretty horrific. So, poor guy.
Absolutely incredible. All right, Tim, as I make everybody do, mm-hmm. can you take us home with a quote, a saying, something else that sticks with you? It can be from Jurassic Park. And if you just want to say clever girl several times, that's fine with me. Or if it's something else entirely, I would love to, you know, peek into your brain for a little bit and see what you got hiding away in there.
I think so. I have two quotes. I have a main quote, and then I have a little bonus quote.
Ooh, bonus quote. And we'll get to that first quote and the bonus quote right after our final ad break. We'll be right back.
I was thinking last night about a quote that I love that I think sums me up. I don't know if that's good or bad. Winston Churchill once said, one of my favorite things, the quotes he said was, "My tastes are simple. I'm easily satisfied with the very best." And I think that's great. That's words to live by right there. It's, you know, Winston Churchill, a great man, could be also maybe not the most cordial or a bit abrasive from what I understand. And just very funny quotes. That's a great quote. I love good things. I like quality things. My mom and dad have a saying that's very stupid, but it's true. A good wine is better than a bad wine. And you know what? It's true. So things of quality, and speaking to this movie, like you look at that, that's a good example of everything. Everyone did everything to their best abilities. Everything looks and feels lived in and real. And yeah, I love that one. Then I have a bit more of an intellectual quote from a Danish kind of philosopher called Storm P. Storm was his first name. P, I guess, I think it was his full name. Robert Storm Peterson, I think, was his full name. But he was known as Storm P. And he has, I'll translate this to English. He was Danish, but it goes like this. "It's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future." And that is also true. So that is where I will leave it. It's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future.
I love those.
So yeah, you know, a good wine is better than a bad wine. I guess that should have been the quote, really. I stole my parents' quote. That should be, there's three quotes, a lot of quotes here, but yeah. "My tastes are simple, you know, I'm easily satisfied with the very best." So what's to live by?
Formative Media was created and is hosted by me, Christian Spicer. So great having Tim McEwen join us for this episode. You can find more of Tim's music by listening to The Midnight, and you can see them across the U.S. throughout April and May. You can also follow him on Instagram at @VarsityBlueTim, and you can read his reviews on Letterboxd. This show was made by real people for you. Our amazing opening theme song was made by today's guest, Mr. Tim McEwen. Our podcast album art photograph was taken by Jordan Epstein. And a massive thank you to AJ Filari for all the editing. And of course, thank you for listening. You can support the show and make sure it continues by going to patreon.com/formativemediashow. Until next episode, live the moments you'll be nostalgic for later. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.